Good morning. I'm Richard Parker. I'm very grateful for having been invited to the conference and only sorry that I can't be with you today. What I think I'd like to do, since I'm the only lawyer in the group other than my friend Akhil, what I'd like to do is sketch quickly for you how populism has figured and can figure in the study and practice of modern American constitutional law, and what effect it has had and can have. But first, let me just say a few words about myself. I've been teaching constitutional law at Harvard Law School since the mid-1970s. But before that, I was a real person. And in college, I was part of what was then called in the 1960s, the New Left. And I was a community organizer, managed to get myself in jail a couple of times. And the point is that I truly believed and still believe in the slogan, power to the people. That's the basis of my commitment to populism ever since the 1960s. So now, how has populism figured in the study and practice of modern American constitutional law? I think I'd better first of all put aside a quite familiar dispute among at least academic constitutional lawyers, and that's the dispute between originalism, confining the meaning of the U.S. Constitution to its original public meaning, and the living constitution, or living constitutionalism. Originalism, in my view, is a red herring. That's not our topic for today. It seems to me that quite clear that living constitutionalism is not an idea but a fact to which we simply must adjust, and a fact that is amenable to the influence of populism. Now, since the 1980s, there has been another organizing debate about constitutional law, quite different from the originalism, living constitutionalism debate. And it's been a debate about the idea or ideal of democracy that ought to, and to some extent has, guided, influenced, and structured argument about and within American constitutional law. The image of democratic politics that underlies modern constitutional argument. Since the 1980s, there have been really three waves of academic argument within this larger debate, three waves that I think it's safe to say have occupied the attention of constitutional law academics who you might loosely call on the left, which is where I'm coming from. In the 1980s, there was an idea of democracy called republicanism, which, as I'm sure you know, achieved currency in many fields, partly as a result of the work of Bernard Bailyn and Gordon Wood about the American Revolution and original Constitution. Then, beginning in the 90s, I would say, there was a gradually growing wave of discussion of something that was called popular constitutionalism. I was part of both of these efforts. And then beginning perhaps in, let's say, 2005, there were more than a few people in the field who actually went beyond popular constitutionalism to talk about populism. Now, I first published a book that I subtitled A Manifesto of Constitutional Populism in the mid-90s. I first committed myself to the idea of constitutional populism in the 80s. And I think that makes me at least the one who has used the word before others. Okay? Now, what I want to do is lay out for you in fairly brief order some of the aspects, or perhaps you might say loosely, the tenets of populism as I understand it in its relevance to American constitutional law. First of all, populism is a word that I don't like to use, even though I've just used it five or six times, because it is not, I believe, an ism at all. It is not a theory. It is not a program. It is a sort of politics, of popular politics, and of political values. Now, it's equally important that a populist politics, as I understand it, is a politics that's always open-ended, that can't be defined, can't be pinned down, that is constantly changing. At bottom, I argued in my book in the mid-90s, the root of populist politics is a sensibility, one might say a disposition, a temperament, a particular sort of egalitarian temperament or sensibility, one that respects ordinariness, ordinariness in others, citizens, voters, and I think most importantly, ordinariness in oneself. I'm just going to get myself a drink of water here. Ordinariness in oneself. That, I think, was the most radical idea in my book, because I think that has been sadly lacking among constitutional law academics over the years and has led to a lot of the perversions and diversions of academic debate. So the net result to this point of my idea of a populist politics in constitutional law is that if such a politics is at the bottom of constitutional debates about arguments about constitutional legitimation or delegitimation, constitutional argument, constitutional law, constitutions have no foundation. They certainly provide no foundation in the ordinary sense of that metaphor. Thus, just as there is no such thing as populism, there is no such thing, in my view, as constitutionalism. Now, that means that if a populist sensibility, a populist politics, is what underlies and should underlie constitutional debate, that would quite radically upset orthodox ideas about constitutional law, constitutions, and constitutional debate. Let me mention 5 points, and these are the most fundamental. First, if the politics, the democratic politics underlying constitutional law respects ordinariness and thus political equality, we cannot exalt, as has so often been done, particularly by centrists in my field, the idea of deliberation, deliberative democracy, That is an inherently hierarchical, elitist notion of what citizenship involves. Instead, we should respect the vote. We should respect voters, no matter whether they have participated in any discussion of an issue, no matter whether they even understand the issue fully. Okay. Secondly, we must detach the idea of constitutional law and constitutional argument from high ideals, high aspirations, much less redemption, as has been suggested by Jack Balkin. Instead, the spirit of constitutional argument, undertaken in a populist fashion, must be realistic, at all times realistic. Ideals are the kinds of things that fascinate elites, intellectual elites in particular. Point number three. A constitutional law or practice of constitutional argument that is informed by a populist sensibility and politics should not get hung up on left-right positions, at least when it comes to debates about the legitimacy of some action in question. Okay? We should respect the legitimacy of any decision to the extent that it has been taken by ordinary people, particularly ordinary people at the ballot box. Just as we respect the vote for president, we don't question whether the voters knew what they were doing. So too, whether we're on the left or the right, we should not criticize the legitimacy of popular opinion or, in particular, popular votes on controversial questions. That's the third point. Fourth, we must give up the idea that the point of constitutions and constitutional law is to promote political stability. We must admit into the heart of constitutional debate about the legitimacy of whatever actions are in question, admit into the heart of that debate political conflict. And finally, and perhaps most controversially, we must give up the notion that a constitution and constitutional law is supposed to promote or guarantee political cohesion or community. Conflict will not promote, at least in the short run, much in the way of cohesion or community. Along those five lines, populism is, or populist politics, I should say, is truly a radical idea once admitted into constitutional argument. Fundamentally, the way populist values and sensibilities figure in debates about constitutional law right now is in challenges of a sort that populists have launched many times, challenges to an elite. In particular, what I have called a governing class or a political class, a group of people who think they're better, think they know more than ordinary people, whether they wear judicial robes, whether they sit in Congress or the White House. I believe that in America right now, there is a growing alienation between the political class or governing class and ordinary people. An alienation that it ought to be, I believe, the mission of constitutional law and argument to challenge at every point. To give you one example, we now have a Supreme Court, all 9 members of which went to 3 of the most elite educational institutions in the country, Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, all of them. That, it seems to me, is a disgrace in the eyes of democracy and certainly populist democracy. There is no need to continue the blind respect for elites of that sort. And sure enough, at least, well, I would say on the left and the right, respect for the Supreme Court justices and certainly for Congress has been declining. Constitutional law should now join others in riding that wave. Now, finally, let me say something about the practice of constitutional law. What have I done, for example, to try and live and act as a populist within constitutional law? It seems to me that guided by realism rather than rather crazed ideals, the most practical and important lines to be taken are 2. First, to defend and to promote direct democracy. In 26 of our states, the citizens can initiate a proposition at the polls and can make it a part of their statutory law or their constitution, their state constitution, by a majority vote. The practice of direct democracy is under attack now by the governing class, by the political class, and it needs vigilant defense. It also needs to be promoted. It needs to be extended beyond the 26 states to the other 24. Doing that, defending and promoting direct democracy in the states, is, I believe, a way of practicing constitutional law that serves populist values. The other, in which I've taken part, is reviving Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution, the article that provides for amendment of the Constitution. From a populist point of view, I would say from a democratic point of view, Article 5 is the linchpin of the Constitution. Without Article 5 allowing for amendments, the legitimacy of the Constitution itself as an ongoing matter is doubtful. But as I'm sure you know, it is very difficult through Article 5 to amend the U.S. Constitution. What's required as a practical matter has been required is a 2/3 vote in both houses of Congress and then a majority vote in 3/4 of the state legislatures. But the Constitution has been amended. It can be done. It can be done. And What then is the barrier that we can, as a practical matter, overcome? We're not, as a practical matter, going to change the rules, the procedural rules under Article 5, but we can change the mindset of members of the political class who take it upon themselves, just as they attack direct democracy, to defeat proposals under Article 5 for amendments of the U.S. Constitution. One senator famously said, after a long career, that more than anything, he was proud of defeating constitutional amendments, of preventing them from being sent to the states for ratification. We have to attack that mindset. We have to mock those people, as Saul Alinsky, a famous community organizer, community organizing populist, once said. Okay. And so, finally, what I've done is to participate in, and now I'm the national chairman of the board, of an effort to amend the Constitution in a way that many people on the left find utterly perplexing, but that the ordinary American people for 25 years have endorsed. And that is to reverse a Supreme Court interpretation of the First Amendment prohibiting Congress from protecting the United States flag from physical desecration, burning, being urinated on, defecated on. And so in the mid-90s, the Citizens Flag Alliance, of which I'm now the chairman of the board, proposed a simple amendment granting Congress the power to protect the flag from physical desecration. Time and time again over those years, the last 20 years, we have met with resistance from members of Congress, the political class. Particularly, I'm sorry to say, the Democratic Party, but not entirely. Many Democrats, Joe Kennedy, for example, Bobby Kennedy's son, were with us. In 2006, we got, as we had many other times, 2/3 vote in the House of Representatives and fell one vote short in the U.S. Senate. 66 votes, but not 67. The power of the Democratic leaders, the power of powerful interest groups in the party, managed to turn around one crucial senior senator, Robert Byrd, at the last moment to defeat us. Thus, let me wind up simply by saying that now, just as 50 years ago, my reason for fighting for an amendment like that is driven by the old slogan, power to the people. Thanks a whole lot.